This is The Guardian.
Hi, Regid Ahmed here, coming to you from Gadigal land. News is coming thick and fast out of the United States with the increasingly authoritarian actions of Donald Trump. So every Saturday, we're bringing you an episode of our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, so you can stay across all of it. Here's host Jonathan Friedland.
If there was ever any doubt, this week Donald Trump told us what he really thinks of Europe.
I think they're weak, but I also think that they want to be so politically correct that I think they don't know what to do.
Those words, coupled with a new U.S. national security strategy, have European leaders worried that the Atlantic Alliance is simply no more.
A warning for Europe, saying Europeans face civilization erasure. Those words found in the president's national security strategy, he's branded as, quote, a roadmap to ensure America remains the greatest and most successful nation in human history and the home of freedom on earth.
But what's really behind this break in the old world order? Why does Donald Trump care so much about the internal makeup of foreign countries? And what explains his particular beef with Europe? I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly America.
So a national security strategy is something, it's a strategic document that is required by Congress starting in 1986. And it is meant in design to try to get an administration to establish its foreign policy priorities in its view of the world.
Joseph Steeb is an author and scholar of U.S. military, diplomatic, and political history. He teaches at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Some of them, if you read the ones from Clinton of the 1990s, are very boring. They're very boilerplate. And then others, like Bush's 2002 national security strategy, are really significant. That national security strategy has some really strong claims about U.S. power in the world and U.S. values. And so when it comes to Trump and national security strategies, it's again tough to know exactly how seriously to take them. On one hand, I don't think he reads them. They're created by staff on the National Security Council. But on the other hand, they can signal new priorities and a new set of values that can be quite striking and send signals to both our allies and our adversaries.
And the sending of signals is very much the Donald Trump business. This was not designed to be one of those dull texts that sits on the shelf. They clearly wanted to start an international debate. And do you think in a way it was made particularly for consumption abroad, that this was in a way a kind of warning shot to allies, I'm thinking particularly in Europe?
Well, I think it's made first and foremost for the consumption of the American right wing. It is chock full of right wing language that you have never seen in a previous national security strategy.
The president added, should present trends continue, the continent, meaning Europe, will be unrecognizable in 20 years or less. As such, it is far from obvious whether certain European countries will have economies and military strong enough to remain reliable allies.
It is simply remarkable to see terms from the online right come into official U.S. policy doctrine. In fact, it's the highest policy doctrine because other strategies like the National Defense Strategy, the National Maritime Strategy are supposed to flow from the NSS. But then probably the second target, almost co-equal target of this would be our European allies because of the pretty dramatic statements about how those countries run themselves and how they look demographically and culturally.
The contrast with previous national security strategies, you've talked about the dull ones in the 90s, and believe me, I felt that pain. But this is a contrast even with Donald Trump's own national security strategy in his first term.
Correct. So in his first term, you had an interesting dynamic because, you know, the MAGA movement, for lack of a better term, was brand new, and it hadn't developed this cadre of foreign policy thinkers. And when we go back to 2016 and 2017, Trump comes into office, he relies really heavily on the established Republican foreign policy elite, right? He has James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. He has Rex Tillerson, you know, CEO of Exxon as his Secretary of State. He has H.R. McMaster, who actually was a general and pretty centrist in his views. And of course, he had John Kelly as Chief of Staff. And all these people were pretty standard, conservative-leaning foreign policy thinkers, very establishment. And there's a struggle in his first administration between those people and the more kind of firebrand MAGA conservatives like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller.
Playing out tonight amid a shakeup on President Trump's National Security Council, the president's chief political strategist, Steve Bannon, has now been removed from the National Security Council.
Today's restructuring, largely due to the growing influence of National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster, who took on the job after Michael Flynn was fired after just 24 days. The military and intelligence leaders initially excluded, now restored to their permanent seats on the council.
Even to the end of his presidency, that conflict was ever really worked out. Think about his last defense secretary, Mark Esper. Mark Esper was widely respected as a foreign policy thinker. He was in line with Trump in many ways, but he's not a MAGA culture warrior. Now what we're starting to see is the MAGA movement has kind of developed the foreign policy ideology, as well as institutions to support that ideology. And you can see that in the NSS.
Yeah, that is clearly the big difference this time around. So let's get into the meat of this document. The big message that has rung very loud and clear here in Europe is that there's some kind of break, that the United States sees Europe now in a very different way from how it has been historically over the decades since the Second World War, to the point where analysts are thinking, has America essentially put itself into a different column of adversary? You know, that there is a degree of fear here.
The document, which lays out U.S. foreign policy priorities, sounds a clear retreat, stating, quote, the days of the U.S. propping up the entire world order like Atlas are over. The message to U.S. allies is that they, quote, must assume primary responsibility for their regions and contribute far more to our collective defense.
My colleague Peter Beaumont, in his analysis for The Guardian, described this moment as one of the most profound crises for Atlanticism, for this relationship between Europe and America. So just to unpack for us, what exactly is in this document that has got Europeans that distressed?
What has them in distress is the criticism of Europe in this document is much more than about just defense burden sharing, which is something the United States has been pressing Europe on, or the European Union and NATO on, for a long time. All right. Obama said, you know, we want to get up to at least 2% GDP spending. Trump wanted more than that, but that's been a longstanding issue. I think what has many Europeans and frankly many Americans stressed about this document is it is wading into European cultural politics in a way that openly sides with the European far right. So it is using the language of the European far right to talk about immigration as an invasion, to talk about demographic change as something that will destroy countries. And it's basically arguing that the United States and NATO cannot exist as anything other than a white Christian alliance. Now, historically, that is to some extent what NATO was, right? It started as a transatlantic alliance united by this foreign policy elite that was mostly white Christian. Of course, these countries have changed significantly, but previous administrations have not argued that demographic change in Europe means the United States can't invest in these institutions or invest in a NATO alliance. I don't want to panic and say this is the end of the NATO alliance. I think it still has tremendous institutional strength, as well as even, you know, most Republicans in Congress are still pretty invested in NATO. But it's a major signal, a major flag.
And it's particularly hostile in this document, not just to those countries in Europe that it sees drifting away from sort of white Christian culture, but also very specifically the European Union. What's the beef that the administration has? We've heard it articulated from J.D. Vance and others on the American right with the institution of the EU.
So I think probably the main thing is relates to the right's idea of sovereignty. This goes back a ways in American history. This goes back to the founding of even the League of Nations and the United Nations, when the American right was exceedingly skeptical of any international institution that might infringe on U.S. sovereignty. You know, even before the Trump administration, the European Union was the kind of liberal transnational project of integration of currencies, of peoples, of ideas, culture, etc., that the right believed is inherently an infringement of sovereignty. They kind of see the European Union as almost a conspiracy to keep down the European right wing.
In England, they voted for Brexit, and agree or disagree, they voted for it. And more all over Europe, they're voting for political leaders who promise to put an end to out-of-control migration. Now, I happen to agree with a lot of these concerns, but you don't have to agree with me. I just think that people care.
So when you think about the way that Vance has talked about the Alternative for Deutschland party in Germany, he basically says that the government has used its power to keep AFD down in line with European Union standards. And so they think that if you can weaken the European Union, right, again, this transnational liberal project, that means you can empower the far right in each of these countries because the far right is anti-EU in almost all of these countries.
Then on this culture point, a theme that runs through it, and I think you picked up on it in your own analysis, is about strength and particularly masculinity. There's a sort of, that is a theme of this MAGA view that Europe is somehow, you hear this on the right, and I think there's a trace echo of it in the national security strategy, but the notion that Europe is weakened, less masculine. What's that actually about? Because you hear it in a few of these speeches. Just unpack that for us.
What the MAGA movement is in part about in American domestic politics is returning the man in the marital relationship and really in the larger society to that normative position where he gets to have the prerogative and the main decision-making authority. Now, you see press conferences, for example, with Trump where there's absolutely no sensitivity to having a single woman in the room, even as they discuss women's issues, right? It looks like a scene from Mad Men. And so when it comes to their sense of order, right, like what will properly order the United States and then order the world, having white Christian men at the forefront, right, having them making 95% of the decisions and having few checks on their authority is their objective. And so you take something like the European Union, which is very rules bound, very bureaucratized. Their resentment of it kind of reflects what you see on the online right, which is an extreme backlash against rules in the workplace about how to treat women or how to treat LGBT people or how to treat anyone in the workplace, and kind of a desire for a return to the jungle-like world of previous workplaces where you can say anything and do anything. So there's definitely a desire for unchecked, unbalanced freedom. That's sort of their definition of what it means to be free.
There is some link here between birth rates, security, and women's particular obligation. Well, just tell us, what is the obligation this document envisages for Europe's women?
Well, the obligation would be, I think, pretty straightforward. It is to help with demographic replacement. So one of the key words that the right uses is called cultural integrity. And you see this with right-wing movements all throughout history. So, for example, in the 1920s, you know, early fascist movements in Italy and even in countries that didn't go completely fascist were obsessed with demographic decline after the First World War. And they all started putting increasing restrictions on women's liberties and women's rights in that decade because of this obsession with decline. And the obsession with decline is not simply about how many people do you have and can you replace them, so to speak, with immigrants from other countries? What they really want to do is make sure that the country looks like what it used to look like, what they think it used to look like 50, 60 years ago.
There does seem to be in this document a fusion, I think it's run through everything you've been telling us, between domestic and foreign policy, that they are becoming sort of one thing. It's all one big sort of culture war, where essentially, unless societies either at home or abroad comply or conform to the Trump view of what makes a good society morally, politically, aesthetically, ethnically, then you can be deemed an adversary. Is that the right way to read this document?
I'm not sure if it's full on adversary. I think that if you think about the way that foreign policy works, right, is you have political appointees with every new presidency, and then you have a pretty stable set of people in the State Department, foreign service officers, and other career professionals who maintain a relationship with other countries that forms a bedrock for the Anglo-American relationship, for European, whatever relations we have with other countries. Those people tend to really value these relationships, really value institutions, and have just a generally more liberal outlook on the world. So that is a bedrock that can be shaken, right? I think that this administration is trying to shake that foundation. So it's a bulwark against the United States sort of declaring Europe as a full-on adversary. But on the flip side, you know, what we're really seeing in this document is kind of a different axis, right, for thinking about, for the American perspective of international politics. So pretty much every national security strategy going back since the beginning basically divide the world into there are autocracies and there are democracies. The United States is on the side of democracies. Even Trump's 2017 NSS says that exactly. This NSS completely eschews that. How close we are to another country is going to depend much more, I think, on its A, you know, align with American culture war, and B, it's aligned with American economic interests, and whether or not it's a liberal democracy is not going to matter very much to this administration, which really means strengthening autocracies.
Yeah, no, that is a big, big shift. It does seem that Europe, the European Union especially, was a big loser from this national security strategy. Nevertheless, there were many who stand to gain. After the break, Joe and I discuss. We will be right back.
The Free Birth Society made millions selling a simple message to pregnant women. You don't need ultrasounds, doctors, or midwives. You can free birth. But behind the scenes, terrible things were happening.
I feel ashamed about this, but I didn't think that the deaths were bad until a year after I left.
Subscribe to the Guardian Investigates feed to get all the episodes of The Birth Keepers. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Out now.
We are back with Joe Steeb. I mean, we've talked about those who were disheartened by kind of losers from the NSS. It's clear there were some winners. The Kremlin received this document fairly warmly.
The American priorities in Ukraine now are to end the war fast and to make nice with Moscow, to, quote, reestablish strategic stability with Russia.
Again, there's been a strange duality to Trump's foreign policy with Ukraine. It's gone back and forth, seemingly based on who the last person he talked to is, whether he's going to be very pro-Ukraine or pro-Russia. But clearly this administration is gradually starting to put more pressure on the Ukrainians to give up a lot of territory and a lot of longer-term concessions to have peace with Russia, a peace that I don't think will last if Ukraine doesn't have the ability to preserve its own security in a military sense. So Russia is definitely under less pressure. What's strange about this document is it's like a really, really bad rushed together term paper.
And you get to see quite a few of those, I bet.
Well, actually, no. This is UNC students are much better than this, to be fair to my students. There's no systematic thinking on where to go with Russia, on what a good Russian-American relationship will look like, other than sort of economic deals that enrich elites on both sides. You know, it's also hard to tell, for example, if China is a loser or a winner in this strategy. Parts of this, the NSS on China, are almost verbatim lifted from the 2017 NSS. There was no new rethinking of it. There was no added urgency to China. I think because you can't fit China into American culture war issues, it just simply doesn't drive them.
That's really interesting and perhaps points to where this document emanated, and was it more from those ideologues in the White House who are less thinking in traditional foreign policy terms, but were thinking in culture war terms. In terms of winners, as we said, Kremlin delighted that the message coming from Washington is to sort of back off being against aggression. Also, of course, I suppose that message about destabilizing or potentially looking for, wishing the breakup of the EU, we know that is a foreign policy aim of Vladimir Putin. He would cheer at that. I'm thinking of dictators and autocrats in Africa and the Middle East. Essentially, the document says the days when we used to hector you about democracy, those are gone. So now if you're an autocrat or dictator in those parts of the world, essentially you've had a green light from Washington. But I want to bring it to America's own neighborhood, partly because we talked a bit about this on last week's episode of the podcast. The national security strategy revives a doctrine from 1823, the so-called Monroe Doctrine, and puts Trump's own stamp on it. Just explain to us what the Monroe Doctrine was and what this new gloss on it that Donald Trump is suggesting might be.
Sure. So the Monroe Doctrine is probably the most consistent principle of American foreign policy. I would say every administration since 1823 has adhered to the Monroe Doctrine, but they've had different ideas of what it means in our relations to Latin America. So basically, in the Monroe Doctrine, which is actually written by John Quincy Adams, who's the Secretary of State at the time, the United States declared that it would oppose any further European territorial expansion in North and South America. So there are obviously European colonies there already. The United States wouldn't try to kick them out by force. However, we would oppose any continued expansion. And this was a way of the United States very early on, first of all, trying to kind of limit European influence in the quote-unquote New World. And the flip side of it was non-intervention in Europe. And so the Monroe Doctrine and Quincy Adams' speeches from the time say the Western Hemisphere is destined to be one of free independent republics, with the United States as the most powerful of those republics. And on the flip side, we will stay out of European military affairs. We will not have alliances on the European continent. And so this became a real bedrock of American foreign policy going forward. And Roosevelt, in the Roosevelt Corollary in 1904, expanded this into a much more imperial thing, in which he argued that not only is the Monroe Doctrine about keeping the Europeans out, it is a right for the United States to intervene in Latin American nations if they are misbehaving or going against interests, U.S. interests in some form.
And so people are talking now about this sort of Trump corollary, as if he is putting his own twist. People are even calling it the Donroe Doctrine for Donald Trump. But we did see it sort of play out in a very dramatic way this week.
The United States today seized a tanker ship off the coast of Venezuela. Attorney General Pam Bondi said in a social media post that a warrant was executed for the crude oil tanker that was once used to transport sanctioned oil from both Venezuela and Iran.
This comes after those attacks on so-called drug boats, which we talked about in last week's episode of the podcast. The government of Venezuela called that an act of international piracy. Donald Trump was sort of bragging, saying this was a really big tanker. They've now seized it. I mean, is this just a taking even further that role that, as you explained, established since 1904, where the U.S. acts as a kind of policeman, policing the region in its backyard? Or is this something bigger and newer? And if it is something bigger and newer, how on earth do we square it with the kind of isolationism of America first, while meanwhile really flexing its muscles overseas?
First of all, I've never really seen America first as an isolationist ideology. The first Trump administration and the second Trump administration have not pursued isolationist foreign policies. They've been pretty militaristic throughout the Middle East, throughout other parts of the world. And certainly kind of trying to extend the Roosevelt corollary or to revive the Roosevelt corollary is not isolationist. So I think illiberal is what I tend to go for more. On the specific case of the oil tanker, there's been some evidence in news reports that that particular tanker was engaged in sanctions violations for trading with the Iranian Republican Guard Corps. So that was originally flagged in 2022 by the Biden administration that this was going on. So this, I'm not sure the Biden administration would have done something this aggressive. But there may, I think as we see the story play out, there may be some basis for this action. I think the larger picture in Central America now or in South America now is this totally unprovoked campaign against, first of all, the quote unquote drug boats, which we don't know what they are, but there's no war powers authority to go after them, right? They're not a national security threat. That plus this campaign of pressure and almost a declared regime change policy against Venezuela. And so that to me harkens very much back to the original Roosevelt corollary where, you know, for example, when the United States was trying to build the Panama Canal, we basically fought a quasi-war against Colombia to enable Panama to break away as its own country. And so then we could sign a Panama Canal treaty with them. Yes, it's very unilateral. It's essentially lawless, and it kind of assigns the United States this position as having the prerogative of intervention, regardless of international law or any kind of treaty alliance. So it's another significant step that you didn't really see in as much in Trump 1.0.
I'm going to push you just for a final question on all this before we get to our last thing. In a nutshell, who are America's friends now? Who are its adversaries? And how should those who find themselves on the losing end of this, should they push back or do they just have to adapt to this new reality?
If you're talking about the American government, this administration, its friends are global autocrats, whether in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, etc., global autocrats through which the United States can project influence and have strong economic ties. And they are far-right parties around Europe and around other parts of the world that they see as aligned essentially with their culture war. There's no point in giving in. There's no point in ceding ground. They see this as an existential struggle. They are almost as openly opposing liberalism and democracy as they possibly could be. And so there's no way you can sort of steal their momentum. There's no way you can appease this particular worldview.
Yeah, no, it is somehow very different. And I hope people in European capitals are listening to your words. This is perhaps something they cannot just accommodate. They are going to have to push back on. Joe, we always do like to ask our guests a what else question, something completely different, although of course it does relate a little bit. And that is the new plan that's been proposed that would make visitors into the US be obliged to present 5 years worth of social media posts to border agents to be examined.
Also, emails that they have used for the past 10 years and the personal information of direct family members, including their phone numbers. The Trump administration, Mugo, says the changes are designed to comply with an executive order that the president says will make it easier for the U.S. to deny entry to people who may pose a threat to national security or public safety.
Unsurprisingly, a lot of people who are, you know, friends of the United States and like to visit often have expressed concerns about this plan. It's only a plan at the moment. What's your sense of whether or not this happens and what it could mean?
It's clearly designed to police people from entering the country who might criticize or try to embarrass this government. I have no idea if this is bureaucratically possible. A Brit with 10,000 posts on Blue Sky, is someone going to be reading those? Odds are they would be using artificial intelligence to try to figure out if they're saying nice things about Trump or bad things about Trump. And it'll also be fascinating to see how this gets applied in the World Cup, because I have a lot of trouble seeing the United States, as it lets several hundred thousand people into the country to attend the World Cup, combing through all of these people's social media records when they're supposed to be coming here to enjoy soccer and spend a lot of money. You know, something tells me that the Gulf state elites who come to the United States won't be having their social media checked all that closely. First of all, it's culture war signaling. And second, it's probably an attempt to simply intimidate anyone who might come to the U.S. who doesn't share these values.
Good point about the practicality and indeed the World Cup. Joseph Steeb, thanks so much for joining me on Politics Weekly America.
Of course, my pleasure.
And that is all from me for this week. For anyone wanting to learn about the rise of Christian nationalism, which we've been discussing, but in the UK, do listen to Friday's episode of Today in Focus with Helen Pidd. And before I go, an absolute must listen is The Guardian's new limited series called The Birth Keepers, the 6-part investigation by Shirin Kelly and Lucy Osborne reveals how two influencers made millions of dollars radicalizing pregnant women around the world and the trail of tragedies that follow. Just search for The Birth Keepers wherever you listen to your podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye. The producer is Danielle Stevens, the executive producer, Maz Ebtahaj. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Thanks, as always, for listening.
This is The Guardian.